when you belong to a community, to a scientific community, this scientific community is not the same as science. Scientific community is a nucleus which is within a social structure which is established. And this established social structure is established within the capitalist network. The principles of this community, it should not surprise us, that are very close to interests of capitalism. So we could start talking in other terms. When you talk about global climate change, you're not talking about climate change is related to capitalist mode of production. You'd be not only against the principles of your social group. So you change your discourse, you make it more vague, and you say that climate change is due to human activity. You see, there is a confusion there. There is a confusion. There is a profound confusion there. What I'm trying to tell you here is that the only way in which science can say something interesting in this time is if it breaks its binds with the historical power that binds it to power, and it becomes completely committed to the intellectual discipline and principles. Okay, so to finish this, I'm telling you, more than anything else, is an invitation to talk, to dialogue. If science looks for sharing knowledge between humans, what science is searching is something that we could call community. The scientific discourse comes from the West. But the West is not the only alternative for humans. There are other alternatives. So I think the best interlocution between this culture and other cultures could be achieved through the intellectual principles of science. Not because science has absolute knowledge. I've said this, science cannot have absolute knowledge. The only reason that science can be a kind of door to talk to other cultures is that science, in contrast with other intellectual disciplines in the West, is not based in its discourse just through reasoning and argument, but it does it with something that we can share with everybody, which is our capacity of perception. I hope that this that I'm telling you, that more than anything is an invitation to dialogue. I hope that this can give rise to some kind of discussion, argument, in which I'll be more than, I'm very committed to talk to you. I thank you again that you invited me, and in this brief time, I'd just like to remind you that with our Zapatista partners that invited me, we can bond and exchange questions and answers. Thank you very much. We thank the participation of Dr. Malva. Now we'll have the participation of the Master in Science, Amaranta Ramirez Terrazo. She's a biologist and a professor in the science faculty at the National University in Mexico. Her specialty is mushroom biology, and she's doing now a PhD in ethnomycology. The title of her participation is Local Knowledges: Starting Point for the Construction of Scientific Knowledge. Local Mycological Knowledge, a Live Example of Resistance of the People. We give the word to Master Ramirez. Good morning. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks to the Zapatista Compass for trying to make this effort to bond with scientists. And more than being present here, I think that for us scientists is an obligation to participate in this kind of activities and calls from society, so that we take a posture about the situation in our country. I will talk a bit about fungi. As an introductory aspect, it's been said before, there's a great diversity, there's a great biological diversity. This is considered as a mega diverse country because it contains 12% of the biodiversity on Earth. It shows all kinds of ecosystems, and it has some characteristics which are unique to our territory, as the humid places in Cuatro Ciénegas in the north of the country, in Coahuila. We have many endemic species too, which means that we only find those species in Mexico and nowhere else. These endemic species have as a consequence a great genetic diversity, which also carries a big biological diversity. According to CONABIO, we are the first country with most diversity of reptiles, the second in mammals, the fourth one in plants and amphibians. But also in Mexico, we have this characteristic of a pluricultural composition. There is a great diversity of cultures. This cultural diversity establishes the way in which we see the world and how we comprehend it, and also how we relate to our environment. So this gives rise to the fact that originary peoples have specific knowledge, traditions, and languages that characterize them and give them a certain cultural identity. So according to INALI, we're the fifth place in the world with more cultural diversity, with 291 languages. Due to this, there is a great mixture diversity in which the places with most biological diversity, there's also big cultural diversity. So a long time, cultures have learned to use and manage the resources in their environment, be it bioresources, that is the resources which are alive, and the resources that have no life, as the mountains, water, air. But also these abiotic and biotic resources are important elements of the cosmovision of originary peoples. All these elements compose our biocultural patrimony, and this is entangled with the bio, life, and ethnos, culture. So without culture, life is not useful, and without life, culture is not useful. So for example, peppers, corn, zucchini, other species, if humanity would disappear, these species would disappear with it. So this means there's a dependency between diversity of culture and diversity in biology. Unfortunately, this 2 decades ago was more visible, but due to the loss of both cultures and biodiversity, this is being lost. And well, with respect to this, originary peoples have a local knowledge. So all the knowledge they have gives local knowledge which have been a space of resistance, because they have allowed the existence of originary peoples. And this way, after 500 years of the colonization, we still have this diversity. So local knowledge is cumulative, it's dynamic, and it's adaptive too. But it can also be altered, lost, or eroded as a consequence of economic and technological changes. It also has a characteristic that it can be it's transmitted generation to generation through the word, through practice, and in very few cases, it's written. So this characteristic makes it specially vulnerable. So local knowledge itself, it's a space of memory and encounter built by the day-to-day experience and integrated to the practices that reinforce cultural and biological diversity. And well, in the environment, besides plant and animals, we have these fantastic organisms which are fungi. Fungi, almost nobody pays attention to them, but they have great relevance in day-to-day life of the whole humanity. and the people relate to fungi, and in relating to them, they know them, they use them, and they manage them. In this way, to put this in context, I'll tell you why fungi are different than plants and animals. Up to 1969, they thought that there were only animals and plants. But Whitaker, he proposed, it's been mentioned before about this classification of organism, he proposed a fifth kingdom, which is the kingdom of fungi. So we can find organisms that are producers, that is plants and algae. So they produce their own food through light. We have organisms which are consumers, so those organisms like us that we need of other organisms to survive. And we have other organisms that are in charge of degrading, that is to reintegrate nutrients to the soil so that they can be used. And these are fungi. So without fungi in the planet, we'd be covered in organic residues, because it would be accumulated. So why are fungi different? Because they have different cellular structures than plants and animals. They have a different number of cells, the way in which they feed themselves is different, and their way of life is also different. I will explain now some things. We were told yesterday about the cell. And the institutional school teaches us that there are two kinds of cell. Vegetable cells and animal cells. And when we go to middle school, we paint this picture in which we contrast the two types of cells. But there are not only two types of cell. We also have the fungi cell, and the fungi cell is different and has completely different functions to the other two types of cells. So the fungi cell is a set of filaments. It's like a great pipe system, microscopic system. Fungi are microscopic organisms. And inside it has these little organs. And in these pipes, in these tubes, you have all these organelles. So this cell we know as hypha. And the set of hyphas, they produce what we call the mycelium. Mycelium, as you've probably all seen it, it's this cotton-like thing that when you take leaves from the ground, you see this, or in your bread, it starts forming this fungus in tortillas and in drinks. This is mycelium. These are fungi, and there are different kinds of fungi. Some of them are the single-cell mushrooms, that they have only one cell. And in them we find the yeasts, which produce cheeses or wine or beer or pulque or tezuino and all those fermented drinks due to the kind of respiration that they have. And they produce alcohol and lactic acid. And fungi are cosmopolitan, so there are some of them live in the water, and they're also microscopic, so we need a microscope to be able to see them. And this water fungi, they form like a little pouch which produces the cell. The mechanism, the reproduction mechanism, is spores. And these spores have like this tail like sperm. We call this a flagellum. And this allows them to swim because they're in water. And it's also very important because they're parasites of reptiles and amphibians, principally from frogs. These are called chytridiae. And we have also multicellular fungi, which are formed by these filamented cells, which we call hyphas, and which have branches. Mushrooms are eukaryotic organisms, so they have a membrane, they have a wall that encompasses the genetic material, and they reproduce through spores. It's similar, it's like the seed. And their wall is made of chitin. It's this chemical compound that that allows Don Durito to be strong. We also have chitin in our nails and hair. So this chitin, this protein, so the fungi are more alike to animals than to plants. So science was wrong until a short while ago. So another of the characteristics that they have is that they have this compound called glucane. So science has proved that glucanes are compounds that help to strengthen the immune system. So they help to prevent diseases. So they have a big component of glutane. So these glucanes, the science has proposed that fungi are nutraceutic organisms. What does this mean? That when we eat them, we are protecting ourselves to prevent certain diseases. So, as I was telling, fungi are heterotrophous. So what does this mean? It means that they need other organisms to feed themselves. They cannot produce their own food. They need to eat like us. And they feed themselves through absorption. What does this mean? The hypha comes and it grows and it shoots out these enzymes. These are chemical components, which are like little scissors. And they help to chop down nutrients to make them smaller molecules, which are easier to be absorbed by the organism. So the hypha throws out these enzymes, it degrades the substrate, so the place where the mushroom is growing, and as it advances, it absorbs it. And that's how it feeds itself. Furthermore, while it grows, it starts branching out, and it forms this this sphere of hyphas, which is the mycelium. Okay, so how diverse are fungi? So in reality, we haven't studied all of the fungi. We've only studied 1% of these organisms. But there are estimations, mathematical calculations, based on these associations that they form with plants. It's said by each plant is associated to 7 fungi. So with this approximation, there is a calculation that in the world there are 1.5 million species of fungi. With the same calculation, we estimate that in Mexico there is about 15,000 species. However, these associations are just being considered with plants. It's also posed from biology that the most diverse kingdom are insects. But guess what? Fungi are also associated to insects. So if we count fungi that are associated to plants and to insects, fungi might well be the kingdom with most diversity in the world. So well, this diversity is reflected in multiple forms, multiple colors, sizes, and structures for reproduction. We can see below microscopic fungi, and perhaps you can recognize some of them. The one on the leaf is a roya, and this is a parasite of the coffee plant, and this hurts a lot coffee plantations. In the middle we can see these microscopic structures that allow reproduction, and above we see some mushrooms that form structures that have a larger size, and we can see them with our own eyes. They have different shapes, colors, tastes, and they're also beautiful. Well, okay, I'm a mushroom biologist, so I love them. Okay, what are the functions of mushrooms in the forests? They're not only important for culture, but also for forests. As I said, they're the main decomposers of organic matter. Without these mushrooms, forests would be full with organic refuse. But yeah. So mushrooms, I had told before that they are associated with plants. This is called a symbiosis. Symbiosis is like marriage. when a marriage works well, the woman puts certain things, the man puts certain other things, and they both contribute to a good life. That's the same way with the fungi. Fungi are associated to different elements, and their associations, the most important associations, are two. One is mycorrhiz, which are these associations that they form with plants. So what happens? They associate, fungi associate and give certain benefit to the plants, but also the plants give a benefit to the fungi. There are seven kinds of mycorrhizae. I will only mention two, because they are the two most important ones in this context, which are ectomycorrhiz, which are formed from the union of the roots with the hyphas. And these roots with the trees with hyphas allow for this communication. So up until a few years ago, it was said that in forests and rainforests, plants were competing for light. But that's not true. If we go to the soil is something which is very important for organisms, for living organisms. If the soil is not rich in nutrients, no organism can live properly there. So these fungi, what they're really doing is a communication network between all the plants in the forest. So they're not really competing for nutrients. They're really sharing the nutrients through this great fungi network, which is in the soil. There's another association, which are lichens. This is the association between an algae and a fungi. And this association forms these things that we've seen. You've probably seen them in the forest. It's like this crust on the trees. It's like this beard that sometimes hangs from trees. So due to these characteristics, there's also great importance for humanity. One of these is fermenting yeasts for fermented drinks, as pulque, wine, beer, but also for making bread. Thanks to fungi, to yeasts, we can make bread. That's what makes bread rise and get this fluffy consistency. But also fungi work as food in the case of cheese, for example. They leave mushrooms live in cheese, and they increase its nutritional value, but they also increase its cost. So we have some cheeses with mushrooms that are really expensive, but they're really tasty. And we have these sexual structures that produce spores, and these are directly edible. But they also are in charge of degrading and killing things. We can also use them as biological control, therefore. We can also use them to kill parasites that grow in cows. These nematodes that grow in cows and that they can kill the cattle. So mushrooms are producers of secondary metabolites. These are substances that have an effect or that they can be used in some way. So in this sense, we have steroids, antibiotics, and here I will refer to this, the most commonly known antibiotic, which is penicillin, which is produced by a fungus, which has greatly increased the life expectancy of humanity. And now that's why there's so many of us. So antibiotics are also produced by fungi. We also have growth hormones and some industrial enzymes, which, believe them or not, we use them in day-to-day life. Now it's very fashionable to use these washed pants, and we use fungi for producing this. So we also use this for agroforestry, and this allows to keep healthy crops and healthy forests. So a crop with many fungi, with mycorrhiz, is a healthy crop and a healthy forest as well. So forest and a crop with many fungi is a healthy one. But they can also have negative effects for humanity. There are parasites of plants, there are parasites of animals, or like the fungi that we can get in our feet or in our skin. and they can also provoke some allergies. They can also deteriorate houses and archives and furniture, and sometimes some of them are deadly. They're toxic and deadly. So this relation between cultures and fungi is studied by a discipline called ethnomycology. Ethnomycology is the area of ethnobiology, which studies traditional knowledge and manifestation and implications of the culture and in the environment derived from the established relations between mushrooms, humans, through space and time. It also studies the mechanisms through which knowledge is generated, transmitted, and evolves related to fungi. Understanding local knowledge about fungi is that knowledge produced by the local communities thanks to the process of observation, trial and error, constructed collectively, which is also a product of the presence of fungi in day-to-day life, and the need to understand their nature, use them and satisfy material needs and also spiritual needs. So ethnomycologists, we study this relation between ethnos, culture, and mycus, so fungi. So when we study this, it's a discipline, multi and transdisciplinary, because we use methods and theories from social disciplines, from medical disciplines, and of course from biological disciplines. So ethnomycologists, we ask questions like what knowledge do cultures have about mushrooms, what are the traditions, what do they think about them, and how do people act in relation to fungi. And it's been documented that the role of the woman has been very important in this task, because women are present all through the process of using fungi, from the collection, selling, or cooking food. So, in contrast with other local knowledges, in this knowledge, women are fundamental because they're the ones taking care of this knowledge and transmitting it. So, women, let's keep transmitting our local knowledges. So, knowledge of local fungi, what's known, due to time, I cannot tell you all that we know of the relation between cultures and fungi, but I will bring here, I will only tell about the most relevant usages for different cultures. When the conquerors arrived, there was a tradition of consuming sacred mushrooms, what scientists call neurotopic mushrooms. There's evidence, like in Codex, that this is a very old relation, and that this was used to use for a medicinal use of fungi and to get in touch with the deities. But when the conquerors arrived, Toribio of Benavente wrote in one of his works, it's apparent that fungi, which in their language they call Teonanaka, which means meat of the gods, it's a communion, it's a bitter communion with their God. This was very, very similar to communion in Catholicism. So missionaries imposed their religious thought and forbade the consumption of these fungi. So what this brought was an obscure time where a lot of knowledge about fungi was lost. And even it was the fact of that fungi were useful was denied, and people were burned for using fungi. So back in the 50s, in 1950s, the usage of fungi was rediscovered, and now it's a cult that is still very much alive in the south of the country, mainly in the state of Oaxaca. So this rediscovery, it brought an impulse to the development of Mexican mycology. When we rediscovered fungi, we said, okay, ooh, these organisms, they exist, and we should study this relation. However, with the movement that this gave rise to and the presence of hippies in Huautla de Jiménez with María Sabina, again gave rise to a prohibition of its consumption from the state because they're considered as drugs. There are 11 species that we know with neurotopic properties, and they're used for rituals and to cure diseases of the body and the mind. We've also reported the usage of 170 species of medicinal mushrooms and also 30 lichens. And the usage of these fungi in traditional medicine is multiple. And it goes from a soup to cure a hangover, or huitlacoche, which is used to cure wounds. And also in local perceptions from traditional medical doctors, they say that all edible mushrooms are medicine. So we can see that this does not differ much from the posture of science when it puts forward the presence of glucanes. They're nutritious, edible mushrooms. We have 371 species of mushrooms that we can eat, and we still have a lot of them to discover because there are places and cultures that haven't been discovered. And every time that ethnomycologist goes to a new place to do research, they find new species that are edible. So they have great potential because they're fundamental for food sovereignty. So how does science know that mushrooms are edible? Well, because people tell us that that they're edible. Otherwise, we could not go around the world and collect 1.5 million species and prove if all of them are edible. We start from the local knowledges, and therefore we know if you can or cannot eat mushrooms. Also, the way to prepare these organisms is very important. Okay, are you recognizing some of the dishes here? The way of preparing these organisms is very important because the traditional culinary, the culinary traditions makes the difference between making a mushroom edible or not edible, or whether it will taste all right or not. And this is in the way that women have learned to prepare and get all the culinary potential of mushrooms. So it's very important, the knowledge of how to cook mushrooms is very important. Furthermore, there are mushrooms that are toxic for science, but that originary peoples consume them, and they consume them because they have ways to prepare them to make them not toxic and allow them to be edible. This is one example. This is a gyromite, which has a substance that are eliminated when you boil this mushroom. So in the traditional thought, you say that this mushroom has to be boiled even three times in water, throw out the water, and then you can eat it. So you see, the way in which women prepare things is not trivial, it's very important. We also have toxic mushrooms, unfortunately. We know about 100 toxic species, or which are suspicious of being toxic. 9 of these are deadly, and the question is, how does science know that these mushrooms are toxic? Well, because people tell us. Or unfortunately, because people get intoxicated and die. So from this, we do research, scientific research. So in warm zones, like around here, we find that the knowledge to identify species that are edible or not is very precise and very punctual. On the other hand, in the rainforest, the knowledge is less specific, and what is said is that you should only eat mushrooms that grow on wood. So in warm zones, we found that mushrooms, edible mushrooms, are known from their comparison to the poisonous mushrooms. So in order to learn which ones you can eat or not, you need to know the the poisonous mushroom that you can be confused with and that can poison you. So we call this a dual knowledge because it's constructed from the comparison between what you can eat and what you cannot. So I leave this image to this mushroom is deadly, is completely white, never eat it. It has its hat, its skirt, its all its characteristics. This is completely white, and this one kills. Unfortunately, in Mexico, there have been many cases of intoxication. Chiapas is one of the states with more cases of intoxication. And there, it's forbidden to sell and consume wild mushrooms. And this is a prohibition from the state. So we see that these local knowledges have gone through a series of bans, but they have, however, resisted, and they're still present in the culture, and they're still beneficial for culture. Regarding fermented drinks, we have 10 different fermented drinks in which microscopic mushrooms are a central part in fermentation, but also these fermented drinks are nutrients that contribute to a healthy nourishment. So when they ask me what is there in pozol that helps resistant, I can answer this question. And in my head, I thought about sour pozol, which has fungi in it. And my hypothesis right now is that the fungi are the resistance. So this is homework, and I will answer this question later. So how can we build a scientific practice that helps us survive the wall? Okay, I'm about to finish. It's two more slides. Okay, in front of the prohibition and ban and expropriation of local knowledges and cultural identities, we should enlarge the cracks that we've created with these local knowledges, revalue local knowledges, understand them as a different scheme to explain the world, which has the same value as scientific knowledge, and also empower them and recognize them as something which is important for cultures. But also to promote the dialogue between knowledges in which we build interaction between science and other members of society, in which we build projects that look forward towards communities and with benefits for communities, as well as the transmission of technology that might be the basis for the construction of a science from and for communities with gender perspective, which we cannot forget. So we also should strengthen the intellectuality of originary peoples, looking towards the production of a local science. So the message is clear. We have to finish with capitalist, individualist, and heteropatriarchal thought, with the creation of collective science from below and from the left, which allows for a scientific and technological development that are capable of finishing with the evils of the world. Thank you very much for listening my word.